My first guest this morning is a friend of this show, we like to think, and he's been battling ill health for some time. But perhaps he and his home at Slane Castle are best known for rock and roll. He's played host to Thin Lizzy, Bruce Springsteen, Queen, David Bowie, to mention a few, and he counts some of you two amongst his friends. Lord Henry Mancharles, good morning to
you. Good morning, Mary. Good
morning. This summer, Metallica are the headliners. We talk of that in a moment. But first of all, how's your health?
At the moment, it's pretty good. I've been through a rough patch recently, but now I'm in a good place. I mean, the problem with this terrible disease is it's like a journey. I've been on this journey since 2014. I have lung cancer. And the thing about lung cancer, first of all, is I will have to say that there's a certain stigma attached to lung cancer because people somehow attach it in their minds with smoking. As it happens, I gave up smoking a very long time ago, like when I was 20. And the type of cancer that I have is nothing to do with that at all.
You were diagnosed accidentally, as it were.
I was very goddamn lucky. I was in the States. I was in West Palm Beach in Florida, and I got a kidney stone.
Which, very painful, I
gather. Oh, about between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, I ended up in the ER, the American equivalent of A&E, and there weren't many people around, and I was put through a machine to try and identify the stone, and a very sharp-eyed lady spotted something on my right lung, and cut long story short, then went through biopsies and all the rest of it, got back to Dublin as soon as I could, rang my GP in the meantime, and I had the lower lobe of my right lung removed just before St. Patrick's Day. I've been battling it ever since. Some of it has been easier than other, you know.
Yeah, can I bring you back to Florida? Because people talk about the horrors of getting sick in the United States and America, and the first thing they say to you is, show me your credit card.
Yeah, well, exactly. A particular hospital I was in were actually very good. I mean, they did ask the inevitable question about insurance,
yeah,
but they were human, as distinct from the yogas. That although I did have a slightly bizarre scenario before I actually ended up in hospital, because I went to a medical clinic saying I knew what I had a problem. It was a kidney stone, and it was about to erupt, and they started all sorts of stuff about insurance, and it gave me a complete headache, so I had two pains to deal with. And then 3 o'clock in the morning, they had no choice. My VHI cover kicked in. And so from that point of view, but I value that kidney stone. It saved my life.
And the pain,
I had no symptoms.
At all?
At all. None at all. And this is part of the problem, I mean, is trying to diagnose cancer early. You know, there's a lack of funding and attention to screening, for example, for potential lung cancer patients. And so, you know, that is a problem that will need to be addressed.
Now, you had surgery, but you also had chemotherapy. Now, funnily enough, I know an awful lot of people at the moment who are going through chemotherapy, and they all seem to be different, and they all seem to have a different
experience. It's something to go through, and one of the things that I found most helpful was if I was feeling, and you get to feel pretty depressed, You say it's the drugs, it's the chemicals, because what they're putting into your body is effectively a poison. And as long as you can keep your mindset in that place, because you don't feel great every day and you feel wasted. And the other thing that was very helpful to me in my case were my family, who were incredibly supportive, some good mates who made me laugh even in the grimmest of times.
How grim did it get? How dark was it?
Well, I mean, the journey I've been on has been very rough. I was told at one stage I was going to die, and they were withdrawing treatment. But that was not this last Christmas, the Christmas before. I was very lucky to walk out of hospital alive. And I, you know, the care that I got in St. James's Hospital, I can't speak more highly. I know there are lots of people who sing the praises of the nursing staff, but here's another one.
Right.
You know, it has changed in a sense my perspective on life, because every time I wake up in the morning, I don't care whether it's the sun is shining or it's pissing with rain. I'm a happy man. I'm
right.
Still alive, and
yeah.
I have medical science and my brilliant oncologist and all the people who've helped me.
Right. Because you had a scare recently and you had to go in.
I did. I've been a bit like a yo-yo, but now, please God, I managed to get to London the other day, and boy, even sitting in that aeroplane was a delight. Normally you think, God, an aeroplane flight, but to me it was trying to get my mojo back.
Right, yeah, because normally speaking you would say, oh my God.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So mojo is back, and I wouldn't say I'm fit and fighting, but I'm certainly fighting.
Good. And Metallica is...
Yeah, kind of appropriate, isn't it, to be doing a heavy metal show this year. They have a song which is sort of kind of my theme song at the moment, to me personally, inside my spirit, which is Nothing Else Matters. And, you know, it's great to have a real rock and roll show. I scratch my head a little bit after Guns N' Roses. How do I follow this?
Yeah.
And I, after all, was in St. James's Hospital when Guns N' Roses performed Slain, and I was watching the show on my mobile phone. And then I spent the next couple of days meandering around the hospital in a wheelchair, largely, meeting everyone from porters to doctors to radiologists who had all been to the gig. So I lived it through other people, I suppose, from that point of view.
Was that the only one you ever missed?
It's the only one I ever missed. I did have a rather bizarre conversation with someone in relation to security after that event, where of course I was keen to know whether there'd been any mishaps, and I was told, well, there is a 6'4" totally naked man in the middle of the site. We don't know who he is, and I'm not sure he does either. Anyway, no, Metallica then became an obvious title. There's a thing about Slain, this sort of weird synchronicity, because, for example, Metallica formed in L.A. in 1981. 1981 was the year of the first Slain. They were great fans of Thin Lizzy. They co-toured with Guns N' Roses. They've sold 125 million records. And most importantly, in terms of email and letters that have been written to me over the years, they were the biggest request, which...
What were they, really?
They were,
yeah.
Because Metallica fans are very devoted. And, you know, you realise, obviously, that it's not just the number that comes in, but it's the devotion of the of the fans. And it was made quite clear to me that they really wanted to play Slain, and they've altered their schedule for this show. They absolutely deserve to be up there as a headliner. It's sometimes quite difficult to choose the headline act, because you've got to look at who's touring. And I've got to look to not just now my own sensibilities, but what I call the family committee. And I mean, I have 9 grandchildren and I've got all my own kids. And then my close friends are well capable of throwing their 3 pennies worth in. So it's not a straightforward decision. But in the case of Metallica, it was pretty obvious.
Right.
It's big production, big and brash, and it's...
And they wanted to do it.
And they really wanted to do it.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's pretty good by my book.
Yeah, because it's such a beautiful setting. I mean, for people that haven't been there, it's kind of a natural... It cries out in a
way.
Well,
it's interesting you say that. I mean, that was where the whole idea came from in the first place, because every 15th of August... since I was a kid and way centuries before, there's been what's called a pattern day on the concert site. One of the earliest recorded Gaelic football matches was actually played on the concert site. So there have been things, magic things, happening there for centuries. And, you know, when I came back to Ireland in the mid-70s, and those are very, very, very different times from what they are now, I wanted to do something dramatic, but that was attached to modernity, but respected the past.
Right.
And believe it or not, as far as I was concerned, this had to be rock and roll. And, you know, I was a 60s kid who was jammed off to an English public school. And so the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, the Who, and the Animals, in particular a song called We Gotta Get Out of This Place, had a certain resonance. And I thought, this is tailor-made for open-air rock and roll. And then it was a matter of finding the people I could work with. It wasn't easy. Except for the fact that a gentleman called Eamon McCann walked through my door one morning.
This is Eamon from Derry.
This is, Eamon from Derry.
Right.
Sorry. I know Eamon from Derry, and gosh, yes, but rather different from Eamon McCann. Both extremely entertaining and articulate. And of course, Eamon McCann was Dennis Desmond's original partner.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the rest, as they say, is a bit of rock and roll history. It was different in 81. Yeah.
It was different in 81, and I want to talk to you about that time as well, and particularly where you live. But you said there about a committee. It's not you on your own anymore. It's your son, Alex, to a certain extent.
Yes, I have 2 children living in Ireland. And they both put their pennies worth in. Alex and I've made over part of the estate to Alex, and he was very deeply, he's a co-founder with my wife and myself of the whiskey brand.
Mm-hmm.
We work very closely together, and both Iona and Alex in particular will take the weight off my shoulders this year, because I am under doctor's orders to behave myself.
Yeah.
And in fact, my oncologist has just gone off for a holiday, and the last thing she said to me was, behave. And I recognise that I just can't do what I used to.
It's a difficult father and son. You know, it's a very... difficult thing, because it's an intimate relationship,
yes,
and yet it's a relationship that requires distance.
It is, and I'm sure Alex wouldn't mind me saying this. I mean, we work very hard at it together, and we're very conscious of the difficulties that perhaps could arise. And, you know, you can't, if, for example, you're dealing with long-term thinking, there has to be an element of trust involved. And I had that very much with my father, who was very different than I am. But we had an incredibly close relationship. Mm. And I have an equally close relationship with my son. And he knows how I think, and I think I know how he thinks. Indeed, my youngest daughter also is a very bright young woman, and I certainly take her views on board, because some of the decisions that I make affect them.
Yeah.
And, you know, they love the place and care about the place. And, you know, I had a lovely conversation with my grandson yesterday, and I was telling him that an American tourist who had, we now have a new video production that tourists see when they first come to the castle, and then they go on a tour with a guide. And so I was saying, the tourist was saying to me, well, I really enjoyed the movie and I've enjoyed the tour. And the contribution that your grandson made was most interesting. And I said, my grandson? Because he wasn't supposed to be involved, but he pitched in. And I thought that was wonderful. That really gladdened my heart, because it meant that he was taking a real interest in the history of the castle, history of the family, all of which, you know, is going to be important to him when he grows up.
Right. I'm very conscious that people think that, you know, aren't you lucky? And in some ways, you are. But it's your home and it's your business.
Yeah.
So where do you get a bit of privacy?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, I wrote a book in the mid-'80s and I called it Public Space, Private Life. And it is those two things in conflict. I mean, we're lucky now in that, although I've actually been staying in the castle quite a lot lately because of my illness, and it's just so convenient to be on top of the shop and I can walk everywhere. But we actually live at Beaupark House, which is the other end of the estate, and that is largely a private, although it is open to the public at some stages. Yes, it is difficult. I knew, you know, I was dumped, in a sense, with the responsibility when I was only 25. And I worked in book publishing in London. I had what I thought was going to be, you know, a long career in book publishing, media, maybe even television. And I was sort of starting to map that out. And in fact, I had an offer of a really good a job, which was on the board of one of London's leading literary agencies, on the table. And I'd actually gone out with my wife to celebrate the fact that I'd been offered this job. And the phone rang at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it was my father on the phone. And he said, if you don't come home, I'm going to sell up. I can't handle this any longer. And the then coalition government had introduced a wealth tax. And Dad, like a number of other people, you know, his assets were quite valuable, but his income was very small and the two weren't related. Effectively, he was going to have to pay more in tax than he had an income, and the sums didn't add up. So, as you can imagine, I was pretty shocked, but I flew back to Dublin, and after endless meetings, I agreed to come home. And I've been there ever since. I've never regretted it. And
But it's a lifetime and a family's dedication to a house. Well, a castle.
Yeah. No, it is difficult. And there have been some people close to me who have said, that damn castle again. And I have...
others would think, aren't you lucky to have a castle?
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And I understand that. I get that. Where it obviously became terrible was after the fire... which nearly destroyed, gutted, in fact.
Yeah. And you nearly destroyed yourself.
Nearly, that was a close shave. And it took us 10 years to rebuild it. And we did, we're very proud of the fact that, okay, you get tax breaks, but it took us 10 years to rebuild it. And we rebuilt it out of our own resources, bar which I did agree to, were some collections of coins that were sent to us by school kids in various schools. And I just thought that was just so wonderful. The then government engineered a situation where I was offered, under John Bruton, 80,000 euro for a feasibility study. And I thought, well, that was an insult in itself, because if anyone knew how to rebuild the building. So we did it on our own.
Well, it was a generous offer. I didn't know that. But, I mean, presumably they were trying to help.
Well, a feasibility study, they knew damn well, before they even told me that I had rejected the concept, because I said it was a complete waste of public funds. And then somebody else made extremely personal, insulting remarks by me, which I'm well used to, in Meath County Council, by not giving money to a... But I won't even repeat it on the radio. And so I thought, to hell with it. We'll do it by ourselves. And actually, I had a very good friend in the Office of Public Works who said to me that don't come and talk to us, because it takes 12 people to decide how to drive a nail into a wall. And so we plied our own furrow, and we feel more comfortable.
Notre Dame brought it back to you.
It sure did. I mean, the fire was very dramatic. We were damn lucky not to have been sleeping in our bedroom that night. We were sleeping in Beaupark House, because we wouldn't have been there to tell the tale, nor would our baby daughter. It's just a miracle that didn't happen. I was driving into Dublin and my PA got hold of me about Notre Dame. I mean, I didn't know what the hell had happened to start off with, because there had been talk about Notre Dame and the American football all that. And I said, oh, God, it's something about American football, not realising that the cathedral was on fire. And suddenly all these images came flashing back. I mean, for quite a long time after the fire, I found some difficulty sitting beside a fireplace it was pretty shocking stuff, but nobody died. I mean, to put things in perspective, one of the more shocking events that ever happened at Slane was the murder of Tim Kidman, my gamekeeper and friend, in 1989. And that was a lot, lot worse. But the fire, we got through it and we rebuilt it. And it was... You know, it was a difficult, hard fight. I didn't know how the hell I was going to start. My bank weren't particularly helpful to start off with. And I remember lying in a hospital bed in Lourdes Hospital in Drogheda, and then seeing an image of myself on the 6 o'clock news, and then my bank manager coming in to see me with a bottle of brandy, actually, not even whiskey. I mean, it was... and he said, you might need this. And I said, why? And he said, well, I don't think the bank are going to be very friendly. And he worked for them. And no, they weren't. But we got through
you
it.
You got through.
Yeah.
And but along the way, you decided on the distillery.
Yes.
And that was going very well. Bring us back, because, you know, there's a whole generation that doesn't know what the atmosphere was like here. I know you're a friend of Mo Molum's.
Yes.
But in 1981, when you were starting off, you have the... You know, Anglo-Irish background, you're doing this big thing in Slane. Describe the atmosphere around then.
Well, I thought you were going to ask me this question. And during that time, I was threatened. I had Brits out and all that sort of stuff daubed all over the gates, which was pretty upsetting for my children. You know, in context, and it's always been something that really irritated me. I mean, I was born in Dublin, for God's sake. And my family have lived in Slane since 1703, and in Ireland since 1611. But I got this anonymous letter, and it read, "Irishmen are tortured to death by your British friends. Your class have an easy ride in Ireland. Call off this vulgar festival. You are promoting, while brave men are dying, you British toad." Militant tendency, Meath, whatever, militant tendency, Meath. Now, that is mild in comparison to some of the stuff.
Were you afraid?
No, I was annoyed. I mean, I was concerned and I was very worried about my children. My then father-in-law wrote to me saying he thought his grandchildren should be sent to him in England for safety. And of course, neither my wife or I even considered that particular scenario. It was a very different atmosphere. I mean, there were mock funerals in County Meath. There were black flags hanging in Duleek. I remember being caught in the middle of a mock funeral and then wondering whether anyone recognised me. And, you know, I used to look under my car every now and again to make sure it wasn't being wired. But the effect it had on me, I suppose, you know, when I left Ireland, I went to actually work in an Anglican mission in Africa. I then went to Harvard. After I graduated from Harvard, I then went to work for Faber in London. And suddenly I was dumped back in this situation where what the public, or most particularly people of a particular extreme bent, regarded me, bore no relation to who I was as a person, as a human being, as a Christian, as all the things that make us up, and not that all of us are Christian. It had the opposite effect, because you know, I remember particularly long discussions with Dennis and Eamon over the show and what we were going to do, and I said, "Plough on," and I don't know what it did to me, but it just sort of kind of lit a fuse where I said to myself, you know, unless this country can respect all the traditions on this island, we're not going to make any progress. You know, I just happened to have been born a Southern Irish Protestant, and my father happens to be a peer of the realm. So what? I was still born in Dublin. I lived in County Meath. I'm an Irishman through and through. I used to be bullied when I went to a British public school. One of my nicknames was Boggy. And, you know,
that has happened so often.
Exactly.
To Anglo-Irish kids,
yeah,
that go to public school, yeah, in Britain.
And it's something you learn to live with. And I mean, I remember I gave a speech in Ashbourne many years ago, and it was a sort of black tie affair, and I was talking about reforming the constitution, and I went back to quote Sean Lemass in 1967 when he made an attempt to do that, and it was before, obviously, the government and all the things that involved. Somebody spat in my face after that. You learn to roll with it. And you know, now, I suppose, having been through literally a life and death experience, and I was talking to my wife about it, I just don't, it doesn't have that impact on me any longer. I just, you know, brush it off.
Right, yeah.
You deal with it.
Yeah. Now, you, as I say, were friendly with Mo Moran. Mm. You thought you should brief her from an Anglo-Irish perspective that you mightn't hear too much of.
Certainly that, but also I had, you know, I have moved in very varied circles in my life. I have friends from all sorts of different backgrounds, and it was to give her a perspective. The great thing about Mo is she wanted to learn. You see, for example, the trouble that the existing Secretary of State has got herself into by not understanding Northern Ireland, not understanding Ireland, really, full stop. There is a level of ignorance at Westminster that, in my view, is problematic. But Mo wanted to know, and she wanted to try and see how the moving parts worked. And I hoped, and I think our friendship did that in a small way. And I first met her, I chaired a debate between Sir Patrick Mayhew, who was the then Secretary of State, and Mo in, I think it was Craigavon, or somewhere like in the north. My memory escapes me. And I'm afraid I was probably a bit biased as chair because I took an immediate liking to Mo, and Sir Patrick was a bit stuffy, to say the least. A friendship evolved, and she came to several of the Slane shows.
What did she say to you when they cancelled the peerages?
Oh, well, that was hysterical. So when they took the bulk of the hereditary peers out of the House of Lords, which would inevitably have deprived me of being able to sit in the House of Lords, we went round for dinner to our house in London, and when we arrived, walked past the cop, and the door burst open, and there was Mo with a large beaker of whiskey, which she thrust into my hand and said, "Now, Henry, how does it feel to be extinct?" That was Mo.
Given the whole area we're talking about here, what's your take on Brexit? You're not 100% saying Brussels is marvellous, Brussels is wonderful.
And I'm on record over the years. I write a column in the Mirror since 2002. I think we have to. Brexit happened for a reason, and they're not really Irish politicians don't necessarily always recognise that. I think that people may well be shocked or by the scale of the vote that the new Brexit party gets in the European elections, because Farage is concentrating on a very simple message. And the other thing about Farage is he's getting slicker, he's getting better. He's actually gaining a degree of respect. I mean, we may see Brexit candidates winning seats at Westminster. I think that Brexit party, as distinct from Brexit, may top the polls. The Tories may be seriously damaged by this. I discuss Brexit a lot with my UK friends, come from various different walks of life and indeed sort of family members. And I also try and imagine in my own head that if my life had taken a totally different path, because I do have dual citizenship,
yes.
I am like many Irish people, and excuse me, just a second. And I try and sort of picture if I was in the UK, you know, how would I be reacting to this? And one thing I thought was really interesting, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who was a Remainer, and actually very passionately a Remainer. And I asked him, I said, "How are you going to vote if there's a second poll, a public vote?" And he said, "I'm going to vote to leave." And I was rather taken aback. He said, "I am sick to death of this." And I think the government, the British government, have made a complete hames of it. And I just want it over. And I'm going to vote to leave. And I thought that that was really interesting because I said to her, how many people like that are there who are just simply going to do a volte face? Because we hear about people who voted leave and then are going to go over to Remain, usually from other people.
Right.
And I think that that's a factor.
And you also didn't like Jean-Claude Trichet's dealing with
No, I certainly didn't. I mean, going back to the way that the whole... this country was treated in terms of the financial crash was absolutely appalling. And interestingly enough, I read that the Greek finance, former finance minister with the name I can never pronounce, Varoufakis.
Varoufakis.
The very colourful Greek finance minister. Do you know that he's running as a candidate in the German... in Germany for the European Parliament. I mean, the Greeks got screwed, we got royally screwed, and fair play to the people of Ballyhay, who, I don't know whether you ever had them on, who marched, I think it was every Sunday.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. OK, can I give you a few comments coming in? Lovely to hear Henry sounding... well, and in good spirits. I met him about 25 years ago in the nightclub in Slane Castle. Such a lovely man. Thank you for all the great concerts. I wish him good health. Another one says, I'd like to wish Henry Manchild's very good health for the future and thank him for bringing Queen and Freddie Mercury to Slane. Mm. It was out of this world, Marion. Even today, the memories live on. Henry Manchild is a national treasure. He's one of a kind. Hope he pulls through this terrible illness. Marion, great to hear Henry Manchild on your show, one of Meath's great treasures. Another, Henry very kindly allowed me to scatter my wife's ashes at the concert site in 2008. She was a big Springsteen fan. It was her wish. It was her wish. Her name was Angela Cook. She just wanted to say thank you again to Peter, to Henry, I should say, and send my best wishes. Another one, just a quick email to say I've thoroughly enjoyed this interview with Henry, an inspirational man who decades ahead of his time with the Slane concerts. I wish him the very best as he's currently battling an illness and hopefully he'll be back in full health very soon. Now, I was going to talk to you about all your glamorous rock and roll friends, but we've run out of time. You mentioned there about... having been in a Christian mission.
Yes.
And you do pray.
I do.
But you don't know kind of who you're praying to.
Yes.
But a piece of stone has come to mean something important to you.
It has indeed. It's amethyst. It's a sort of block. And it's beautiful to look at. And it was actually given to me by Princess Haya of Jordan.
Oh, right. We were talking about her recently.
Indeed, who is married to Sheikh Maktoum.
Yeah.
And she actually lived with us for quite a while because she is very into show jumping.
Horses, yeah.
And she was training with Paul Darra. And so I saw a great deal of her. We all did, and she was tremendous fun, very smart young woman, and this was something she gave me, and it somehow has become an object which the family sort of reviewed, and it ended up in intensive care when I was really on knife's edge, and my wife turned round to my oncologist and said, can I bring this in? And I think she said, at this stage, anything would help. And faith is important because if you can believe in something, and I would say a higher being, it gives you strength. And anything that gives you strength and hope when you're dealing with very serious matters, be they illness or a problem in the family or whatever, it energizes you. And in that respect, to be energized by something beautiful, well, that's just good. And I touch that piece of rock crystal every night before I go to sleep.
There you go. Well, listen, I'm glad to see you looking well.
Thank you.
And I wish you really good health for the future and to get through it. As you say, there are twists and turns this road. And we will leave it there. But just returning to the killing of your friend, the gamekeeper, Timothy Kidman, it's important to note that it was a manslaughter.
It was manslaughter. It's absolutely
I know
correct.
And we have to leave that there legally.
Yeah, I know.
Understand that. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Bye-bye.